Go ahead and grab a seat this morning. Come on now, if you're thankful for Jesus, make some noise. I know I am. Every day, every minute, every hour of my life, man, I think about just some of the challenges that we face as human beings, and I don't know how people do it without Christ, without Him walking with us. And so, man, excited to be here with you this morning. Love being able to be with my church family every single Sunday morning. And just to be able to talk about Jesus, be able to get into the Word of God, and it excites me every time. I'm excited about what the Lord has for us today. I was getting ready, prepping for this message this week, and I heard this little story. There was a young girl, a daughter, and she came up to her mom, and she was like, "Mommy, can you tell me how did the human race come about? How did we get here?" Like. And the mom looked at her and she said, "Well, honey, you know, a few thousand years ago, God, He created the world and He created the human beings. You know, He did it in 6 days. And then the last day He created man and woman. And that's how we got here." And so she's like, "Okay, you know, cool." And so she thought about that a little bit longer. She went over to her dad a couple days later and she was like, "Daddy, can you tell me how did human beings come to be?" And her dad looked at her and was like, "Well, honey, a few billion years ago, amoeba kind of grew into a fish, and then that became cats, and then that became monkeys, and then we eventually evolved from monkeys." And so obviously you can imagine in this little girl's mind, she's trying to figure out, like, well, that doesn't make sense. How can one be one way, one be the other? So she goes back to her mom, and she says, "Mommy, I went and I talked to Daddy, and he said one thing, and he said that, you know, we came from monkeys, but you're telling me that God created us." And the mom looked at her daughter and she said, "Well, honey, I told you about my lineage and your dad told you about his." You know, this whole creation thing, the more I study it, the more I look at the world and the culture that we live in, man, it's polarizing. It really is. It's polarizing not just between people who would say they're atheists and people who say they're Christians. It's even actually somewhat polarizing amongst Christians themselves. Like, how did this world come into being? And even if God did he do it in 6 literal days? Did it take him actually millions of years to create the world? Right? How did God do it? There's this major tension going on. And what we've really seen in our culture is that in the scientific community, what they do is they look at anybody who believes in anything supernatural. And they say, that's irrational. That couldn't possibly be. There's no way that some all-powerful, intelligent, super-intelligent being could create the world, right? That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. That's not really all that logical. And so last week, what we did here is we began a series that we're calling In the Beginning, where we're looking at this creation story. We're looking at what God's Word says about it. And I think more importantly, we're looking at some of the actual evidence that there might actually be an intelligent designer to all of this. That in fact, and this is what we said last week as we began this series, that it actually takes more faith to believe that this all just randomly happened than it does to believe that God supernaturally created it. There's a theologian I listen to every now and then named Phil Johnson. He basically said this: whether you believe in evolution, that everything came from nothing, or you believe in God and He created it, both of those things require us believing in a miracle. It does. Think about that. Both of those things are absolutely, truly miraculous one way or the other, right? The difference is, and this was the illustration he gave, evolution is like saying that a tornado whipped through a junkyard and at the other side of it came out with a Boeing 747. That really isn't rational at all. That doesn't make any sense whatsoever, right? Why? Because we talked about this last week. Things that are unordered, things that don't exist, don't create things that are ordered, right? Don't create life, especially, right? It's one thing to believe that maybe somehow in this Big Bang, millions or billions of years ago, matter came into existence, but how do you explain life? How do you explain human beings? The way that we think, the way that we rationalize, right? And so the Christian's argument, the biblical argument is, it's way more rational to believe that something, someone, Some higher power created all of this. And so we started talking about this last week. We really just kind of laid a foundation, honestly. And where we left off with was this. We essentially have two choices in this life. We can believe in this evolution that nothing created nothing, or we can believe that the God of the universe, the God of the Bible, created the world. In fact, he didn't just create it. He spoke it into existence with his words. That there is a power beyond what we truly understand, and we are here because of that power. That's where we left off. We have two choices. Either nothing created something, created all of this, it just happened randomly, or we looked at one verse basically last week, Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You see, I think one of the problems, I'll just call this out, right? As Christians, I don't think we have done a very good job at all of presenting genuine scientific evidence for the creation of the world by the God of the universe. Now, I want to begin by saying this today. Does it take faith to believe that? Of course, absolutely. It takes faith. It also takes faith to believe in evolution, right? It takes faith to believe that God spoke the world into existence, that he created all of this. And yet, there's evidence. I believe there's actually good, logical, rational evidence for why there's a creator. And what I want to do today is I want to piggyback off of what we talked about last week. I want to encourage you, if you missed week one of this series, please go to our YouTube channel, get our podcast, go back, listen to it, watch it sometime this week. Because if last week was kind of 1A of this series, this is kind of 1B. And what we're going to do today is we're going to look at some legitimate evidence for God as the creator of the universe. That's what I want to do today. So I encourage you, take a lot of notes today. We're going to go through some things that I'm going to be honest. My head hurt after studying some of this stuff. I am not that smart. There are people who are way smarter than me, Christian scientists who are way smarter than me. And so what I'm going to try to do today is I'm going to try to just give you a springboard, give you some basics to begin to understand this. But as I often do, I want to encourage you, go study this out for yourself. You know, I used to watch Reading Rainbow when I was a kid. LeVar Burton, he had this catchphrase, right? Don't take my word for it, right? Go and study this out. Get into your Bible. Read the Genesis account of what happened and begin to study this for yourself. Because I do believe it's important. This is, as we talked about last week, understanding this and the theology of this is critical to the way we think and the way we live our lives. All right, so we're going to dive right in today. All right, we're going to talk about a few of the biggest scientific pieces of evidence that evolutionists use and what creationists would say about some of those things. So one of the biggest arguments is this, right? The world isn't 6,000 years old. The world is billions of years old, right? And so there's a lot of people who have trouble, even Christians, reconciling that. Okay, how can that be? Science is telling us that the world is billions of years old, but the Bible claims that it's only 6,000 years old. How can that possibly be? Right, well, there's two words I want to give you this morning. All right, the first one is this, uniformitarianism. I'm going to have it up on the screen because I can barely spell it. Uniformitarianism. Okay, what uniformitarianism is this? It is the belief that over time, the world changes consistently and constantly, and it is always the same. The world changes slowly, consistently, and constantly over time. For instance, let me give you a real life example of this, right? Scientists look at the Grand Canyon and they say the Grand Canyon was formed over millions and millions of years from water flowing through those canyons, glaciers slowly coming through those canyons and creating that giant crevice, this canyon that we know now as the Grand Canyon, right? This happened over time, over millions of years. Some would say maybe even over billions of years. This is uniformitarianism. And uniformitarianism was actually around, this thought process was actually around before evolution. I mentioned this guy's name last week. There was a scientist with the last name of Lyell. He was a precursor, if you will, to Charles Darwin. And he's the first one that kind of came up with this. And it really, what it did was it laid the foundation for Darwin's evolutionary theories. Okay, so you've got this uniformitarianism. This is how the world formed and was created and how we get everything that we see now. Slowly, constantly, over time. There's a second option, though. It's called catastrophism. Throw that one up on the screen as well. Catastrophism. And what catastrophism says is the earth changes through catastrophic events. Major things that happen. Eruptions. You know, fault lines cracking and changing. Right? Maybe a giant flood. We're going to get to that here soon. Right? So there's this catastrophism mentality and ideology. Right? And what catastrophism really does is it helps to reduce greatly the age that the world has to be, that the earth has to be, in order for some of these things to happen. Let me give you some more examples. In Georgia, there is a place called the Little Grand Canyon. I didn't know about this. I started studying this and I found this out. There's this place called the Little Grand Canyon. And in the 1850s, 150, 200 years ago, what happened was that this place was covered with trees. And these farmers came in and they started taking out these trees. Now, if you know anything about farmland, sometimes if you do that, what it can do is it can create runoff. And what happened was, very quickly, over the course of about 100 years, they took those trees away and water started just pushing the dirt, moving it. And if you go there now, there is a huge canyon there. Now, it's not the size of the Grand Canyon, but it is a massive, massive canyon. It happened over the course of 100 to 150 years. If we hadn't seen it happen, here's what evolutionists would say. That took millions of years. That's what they would say. Because by all intents and purposes, when you look at that Little Grand Canyon versus the Big Grand Canyon, the elements of that canyon, the features of that canyon are indistinguishable from canyons that they say took millions of years to form. Right? That's the difference between catastrophism and uniformitarianism. There's another example I want to give you. Many of you in the room maybe are too young to remember this. I was born the year this happened. The eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington. After Mount St. Helens erupted, it created craters so big that they were equivalent to things that you see again in the Grand Canyon. One event, one moment, this massive explosion created things that, again, if we hadn't seen it for ourselves, if we weren't alive to historically look at that, scientists would be saying that had taken millions of years for those things to occur. Right? And so what evolutionists have done is they've taken this science of uniformitarianism, which is really a theory in a way, and they've said it had to have taken millions or billions of years for the things that we see on Earth to have happened. The catastrophist would say, no way. These things could have easily happened sometime within the last few thousand years to create the world that we see today. And I want to argue it's much more likely that a catastrophic event or catastrophic events are what caused the earth to be what it looks like now rather than this uniformitarian idea. Okay, so that's first thing. Those are two huge ideas, understandings, concepts we've got to understand as we move forward. Now, one of the big ones that people ask about, Christians included, is what about fossils? That's a huge one, right? We start getting taught about fossils from a very young age, right? There's these fossils, they're embedded in the earth. They took millions or billions of years to come about, right? Is that true or not, right? This is evolutionists. This is one of their greatest pieces of evidence, this existence of fossils, right? Does anybody in the room actually know how fossils are formed? I'll be honest. I'll be the first one to admit this. I didn't really understand or know exactly how that happened. I have a basic idea. But as I began to study this out more, some really amazing things began to come to light. Fossils are formed and can only be formed when a living organism is buried very quickly under a huge mass of sediment. Because think about it. If something isn't buried under this mass of sediment, what happens? It begins to deteriorate, right? We know this. Things degrade, right? Air, if air is touching that in any way, shape, or form, it's going to degrade eventually. It's going to be nothing. And so what is required for fossilization is some huge mass of sediment buries a living organism deep underneath where there is no air and there's no possible way that it can begin to deteriorate. That's how a fossil happens. Now, when I started to think about that, understand that, right, I began to think about cataclysmic events that have happened in the past. And of course, I went to my Bible because that's the source of all truth. And I began studying out the flood and how the flood is actually the answer to fossils. Right? There's a fossil bed. I want to give you this one. You can write this one down if you want. I don't know if this is how you spell it or not. It's K-A-R-O-O. Karoo, I'm going to call it. All right? The Karoo fossil bed found in South America. There are some 800 billion fossils in this fossil bed. And it is a highly concentrated area, right? We're not talking about all of South Africa. Very, very concentrated. Now, logically, rationally, I look at that and I think, how is it possible if it takes this mass of sediment covering up a living organism to create a fossil, how is it possible that there are that many fossils concentrated in one area if there was not one big cataclysmic event that buried them all at the same time? Right, if it was millions and millions of years, those things would be spread out beyond anything that we see here in this Karoo fossil bed. Right, and so the argument is there was one huge event that buried them. And this Karoo fossil bed, it's not the only one on the planet. There are more of these where there are these concentrations of fossils. Right, and there's no way that could happen unless, again, there was a catastrophic event like the flood that we find in Genesis. Listen to what this says. Genesis 7, 11, and 12. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. I want us to look specifically. It says, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth. We think of the flood, and we just think, oh, God just started making it rain. He's made it rain, right? But the reality is the earth could not have been flooded in the way that it was just by God making it rain from the clouds. What he did was there was this cataclysmic event that opened up the earth. Things began to crack open, split apart. Masses of water and lava and all kinds of stuff began to come up out of the earth when that happened, right? And so there was this massive event. And as it began to flood the earth, right, all of these animals were washed away underneath this great mass of sediment that was being washed from the earth. This explains, I think, pretty well what happened and why we have fossils. And it did not take millions of years for them to form. It took thousands of years for them to form. There's a couple other things I want to share about this that I think are fascinating. First of all, did you know that there are fossils of sea creatures? Sea creatures that are found on the tops of the highest mountains in the world. All over the place. Now, how do we explain that? Other than the earth was covered completely in water. And eventually they were washed under there and they died. Right? And those fossils formed on the tops of the highest mountains all over the place, all over the world. And I believe it actually helps explain the supercontinent. Have you ever heard this? Like Pangaea? Right, we've heard of Pangaea, right? That the earth was all just one big, right? Imagine to get that water out, man, things were just, the earth was completely transformed during the flood as it opened up, cracked open. Mountains probably from the seas were pushed up, right? You know, as the earth shifted and moved cataclysmically, right? That's why we get some of the formations and things that we see in the world today. It can all be attributed back to this flood. Because I believe fossils we find, they're the result of this flood. that happened thousands of years ago, not millions of years ago, and it's very probable. It's just as probable. This is just as probable of a scientific solution as anything else. Okay, let's keep moving. What about dinosaurs? Oh man, every kid loves dinosaurs, don't they? Don't we? Like every little boy especially. My kids, they love dinosaurs. And from the very beginning of their lives, they start going to school, right? And guess what they start getting told? Dinosaurs are millions of years old. They lived 65 million years ago. And so immediately in a little kid's mind, they're already starting to go, how do I reconcile that? My mommy and daddy told me when we went to church that the world's 6,000 years old, that God created the world in 6 days, but there's dinosaurs that are 65 million years old. How can that be? Does that mean there's no dinosaurs? I want to make sure I say this today because I can see some of you are like, oh no, don't crush my dreams. Please tell me there were dinosaurs. I absolutely believe there were dinosaurs. And pretty much every creationist on the planet would say, yes, of course, there were dinosaurs, right? We do have fossils of dinosaurs. We can see that, right? And so if they didn't live 65 million years ago, how is it possible then that we had dinosaurs? How does this reconcile, right? Well, again, I want to point to the flood account, okay? Now, when we look at the flood, we know that God told Noah that he was going to bring onto the ark two of each kind of animal. And that's a really important distinction, right? Kinds, right? When you look at the amount of kinds of animals that there are on the planet, somewhere around 8,000 kinds. Now, within each kind, there are multiple variations, right? Canines or dogs, right, are one kind. Now, there's all different types of dogs. Same things with birds. Same things with a lot of animals, right? But there were 8,000 kinds. Scientists estimate dinosaurs had about 55 kinds. Okay? You tracking with me? All right, so we've got 55 kinds of dinosaurs, about 8,000 kinds total animals, which means on the ark, there were about 16,000 animals, right? Because there were two each. That's good math, right? Sure. All right, so there's 16,000 of these on there. Now, some people would say, how is that possible that they all fit on the ark? Well, let's do some basic math, okay? This is honestly makes so much sense. Without really getting into the math, here's how big the ark was. 300 feet by 50 feet by 30 feet. It had approximately 2.2 million cubic feet inside of it, right? Again, just doing some basic math on the size of the animals, we would have been able to have all 16,000, God would put all 16,000 of these animals on the ark, and there would have still been about half of the ark left of room to put other things on there, food, whatever. And so it's highly likely that the dinosaurs were on the ark. Absolutely, right? Because there's only 55 kinds, right? Now we're going to talk in a few minutes here about DNA and genetics and mutation. That's when I'm really going to make my head hurt, and yours too. But those kinds, okay, those 55 kinds, those 8,000 kinds, they were all on the ark. Every single one of them. Most likely, now we think about dinosaurs being giant, right? I mean, what about the Brontosaurus and like these dinosaurs that were massive? Well, most likely, the dinosaurs that were brought onto the ark were babies. They brought the smallest ones on that they could, right? Also, the dinosaurs that were massive and giant like that were very few and far between. Most dinosaurs, I believe I read, the average size of a dinosaur was the size of a bison. And some of them were much, much, much smaller than that. Okay, and so what I'm just trying to do is I'm trying to, again, paint this picture that rationally, logically, it makes sense that dinosaurs existed, that they could have been on the ark, right? Now, some of you are probably going, why don't we have dinosaurs today? I mean, what happened? Where are they? Well, we have seen in our lifetime species go extinct. Right? Again, this is just logical. Things go extinct. The dinosaurs went extinct just like many, 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 many other animals have gone extinct over time. I also think about things like alligators. Now, technically, that's not a dinosaur. But I don't know about you, I look at an alligator and I go, that thing looks pretty prehistoric, right? I mean, it looks like a dinosaur for all intents and purposes. It's got the teeth and the scales and the, right? And so we see some evidence of creatures like that that are still alive today that made it through that process of man and the earth changing things and killing things off. Right? So again, I want us to see that there is, as we use our brains, right? Like, I so believe this. There are so many people who think if you believe in God, that he created the world, you got to check your brains at the door. I don't believe that. I absolutely believe there's real evidence for this. Okay, so we got fossils, we got dinosaurs, but finally I want to look at this thing called DNA. What I'm going to call the fingerprint of God. Now, when Charles Darwin came up with his theory of evolution, he didn't have a clue about DNA. The human genome wasn't even a thing. Nobody knew anything about it. They didn't have the technology. They didn't have the science to understand this. And I would argue if Darwin was alive today and he had come up with this theory today, that most scientists would have laughed him out of the room because of this one thing, this tiny, amazing miracle that is DNA. Now, every single living thing, I'm going to get real science-y on you here for a few minutes, has DNA from a daffodil to a human being. Every single living thing on the planet, it has some form of DNA. And what is DNA? It is a code. It is a code that tells a living thing, the cells, what to do, what it's going to become. What it is it's actually information. That's what DNA is. It's the informational code that makes a living thing what it is. Now, the question is, where does that information come from? That's the million-dollar question. Where does this DNA code, this information that is infinitely complex, come from? Did you know that one strand of DNA has 1,000 million bits of information in it? That is mind-blowing. The amount of information that you find in DNA. Where does that information come from? I love this quote. I found this on a website I want to reference for you called Answers in Genesis. If you have never been to this website, I strongly encourage you, go to Answers in Genesis sometime this week. Type in literally any question, anything you have into their little search, and there's going to be a whole bunch of articles that come up helping to explain that. Right? This was a quote I found there this week about this whole DNA thing. It says, there is no known observable process by which new genetic information can be added to an organism's genetic code, let alone how that information could arise from random chemicals in the first place. Let me say that again. There is no known observable process by which new genetic information can be added to an organism's genetic code. In other words, a horse's code is a horse's code. It can't be anything else but what it is coded to be. A monkey's code is a monkey's code. A daffodil, a flower's code, is a flower's code. It can't be anything other than what it is, right? The code for a man, for a human being, is not found in a one-celled amoeba. The code in a one-celled amoeba is the code for a one-celled amoeba and nothing more. And there is no science that has ever been able to prove otherwise. Right? Now, this is, I really believe, this is damning evidence against evolution, this whole DNA thing, all right? Now, this is not to say, I got to throw this out there. This is not to say that mutations can't happen. We have all observed mutations happening in a human being. We've seen this. We've seen this in animals, right? But we need to understand this. This is so critical. Things never mutate up. They can only mutate across and down. Now, what do I mean when I say that? It means that you can't add anything new to the genetic code. In other words, something can't evolve from one thing into something higher, into a whole different species, right? Dogs, right, when they came off the ark, I'm going to come back to this now. What I believe is there were two dogs on the ark. Over time, slowly but surely, those dogs became different looking types of dogs. But at the end of the day, are they still dogs? Absolutely, they're still dogs. Did you know that eye color is a mutation? Right, our eyes, the color of our eyes, blue and green and hazel and brown and all the different types of eyes, those are all mutations, right? But they are changing across, or sometimes, sadly, tragically, we're going to get to this in a few weeks, I believe because of sin in the world and because we are deteriorating, there are mutations that go down, right, where information is lost in the DNA. It's missing from the DNA, but there is nothing that is ever added to the DNA to make us something that we are not. In other words, a form of kind of, and I'm careful to say this, a form of like microevolution, or maybe a better way to put it is microchange, is absolutely possible. We are observing that with our own eyes. But macroevolution is not possible. Why? Because of DNA. Because we are coded. Because the God of the universe decided to make us who we are, to put that code inside of us, to create human beings and all life with a very special and unique function. There's another term. It's called the law of biogenesis. This law of biogenesis says this: living things can only come from other living things. That's the law of biogenesis. Scientists all around the world subscribe to this idea. Again, I believe this is damning to evolution. If living things can only come from other living things, then how in the world did we get the living thing in the beginning to start with? It had to come from something higher, beyond our thinking and understanding. It had to come from God himself. Right, this challenges evolution at its most foundational level, this law of biogenesis. And so here's the bottom line. Here's what I want us to understand today. Only an intelligent creator could develop this code, this DNA. That's the only thing that makes rational or logical sense. Now, evolutionists would argue that the DNA, did you know that DNA is like the difference between a monkey and a human being? This is one of the arguments that evolutionists will make. The difference between a monkey DNA and a human DNA is 2%. They share 98% of the same DNA with us. And what evolutionists would say is, well, that's evidence for the fact that we came from the same thing, right? I would argue it's actually evidence for an intelligent creator. Think about it this way. I have a buddy, really good friend, who builds homes. Amazing homes. And his homes have a very distinct look. All of them are different, very different. No two of these homes are ever the same. But they all have, you know, you look at that home, I can tell it's one of his. I know right away. Right, in the same way, any intelligent creator, right, whether you're building homes or you're the God of the universe and you're creating the world, right, it's got his fingerprints on it. It's got his style on it. Right, God's got a style. He used this thing called DNA, and yeah, it looks the same. The foundational product there, this foundational structure of it is the same and yet very different. Do you know how many millions of you know, particles of difference, letters, I guess is the better way to put it, letters of difference there are between that 2% between us and monkeys? It might only be 2%, but it is astronomical. It's massively different. And so when I look at the human genome, and I look at DNA, and I look at who we are and who God made us, man, it's so obvious to me. Someone with intelligence created us. It's the last sciencey term I'll throw at you today, because it's about all we can handle, I think, all right? This is called the teleological argument for the existence of God. This is what the teleological argument says. It says, because the universe shows order and intelligence, there must be an ordered intelligence that created the universe. Right? The universe that we live in, think about the place we live. the complexity of it all, just the complexity of the human body. Because the universe shows this order and this intelligence, it only makes sense that something that understands order and has intelligence created it. Right? This is the idea of looking at the world and going, how could this not have been created by something who has intellect beyond what we can fully understand? I mean, the complexity of it all. And so what I want for us today is this. I just want us to recognize that, number one, God and science are not at odds, because we've been lied to. That's what we've been told our whole lives. God and science are at odds. You have to believe one or you have to believe the other. That's a flat out lie. I consider myself to be a Christian who believes in God, who believes in the creation of the world by the God of the universe. But I also believe in science. I do believe in experimentation and looking at things and trying to rationalize things, right? My faith in God is not blind. It comes from what I believe is really powerful evidence. And I want us to see this today, that there is scientific evidence for the creation of the world. And I believe that science really is on the side of a creator. Evolutionary theories, they fail to explain in any true logical way the origin of life on this planet. And yet Genesis 1:1, and we talked about this last week, in Genesis 1:1, God brilliantly does it in one sentence. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Does this still require faith? Absolutely. But it is faith backed by genuine evidence. I don't know about you, but I look at the human body. I think about the heart, just the heart alone. Forget all the rest of the complexities of the body. Our hearts pump over and over and over again. Thousands and thousands and thousands of times, millions of times in a lifetime. Pumping blood that carries oxygen through our bodies, through our veins, powering us. The brains that we have, how powerful they are, what they can do, the things that we can create. I think about the complexity of the universe and the sun and how if it was just a little further away, we'd be freezing to death. If it was a little bit closer, we would be burned alive. How gravity works, how the world is round and yet nobody falls off of it. How does that work? It's beyond my comprehension. I don't know. It's insane to me. I get it. There's this thing called gravity and it holds us to whatever. You can say whatever you want. It's still insane to me. Right, the complexity of all of this. How about just human relationships and the capacity that we have to feel and to love? Man, it's not an accident. When I look at the world, I don't need any scientific, I mean, I love the scientific evidence, but I don't need it to tell me there's a God. I love how David puts this. Man, David was a man after God's own heart. This is what he said in Psalm 19:1 through 6. He said, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge." Man, when we look at creation, the glory of God is on display. The glory of God is on display. How can we miss that? I don't think you can if you really look at it. Listen else to what else he says. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. And yet their voices go out into all the earth, their words to the end of the world. In the heavens, God has pitched a tent for the sun. He's created it all. Put it all there for our good. He goes on, he says, it is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, the sun is. Like a champion rejoicing to run his course. As we lap around it. Day after day, it rises at one end of the heavens and it makes its circuit to the other. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. And I believe God created this world for our good. And this is kind of where we left off last week. I don't know about you, but I don't want to live in a world where I'm an accident. I don't want to live in a world where I'm an accident. I want to live in a world where a God who loves me, created this world for me to live in and to experience, to take pleasure in. That's the world that God created. David saw it. I believe each of us, truly deep down inside, we know it. We know it. There's something more to this life than we just happened accidentally. And so I'm going to throw these two choices out there again. And with this, we'll be done this week. Two choices, guys. We can believe that this all happened by accident, that nothing created something, or that the amazing God of the universe created us and loves us. I want to encourage you this week, go home and just think about the world that you live in. Is there pain and suffering and evil? Yeah, and we're going to talk about that in the next couple of weeks. Because there's a lot of people that think, oh, because of that, God couldn't have created the world. And if he did, he's not a good one. So stay tuned. But I look at the world and I see something amazing and beautiful. And I see a God who loves me and cares for me. Amen, church?